Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, everyone. On this Memorial Day, we want to re-air an interview that we did with the filmmakers Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington. They made Restrepo, the Oscar-nominated documentary about American soldiers fighting the war in Afghanistan. As you might know, Tim Hetherington, an accomplished and award-winning photojournalist, was killed on the job last month while he was covering the uprising and crackdown in Libya. He often covered conflict zones and the civilians and soldiers caught in the middle. We thought this interview would give you something to think about today on Memorial Day and be a fitting tribute. That was an excerpt of the sound of chaos following a transport vehicle being hit by an IED in Afghanistan. It's from the Oscar-nominated documentary Restrepo, the third in our week-long series of the five documentaries nominated this year for the Best Documentary Oscar. The film is direct, gritty, and hard-hitting. To make it, reporter and author Sebastian Younger and photographer Tim Hetherington spent 14 months embedded with American troops in the Korangal Valley, Afghanistan. Restrepo traces one tour of duty from the soldiers' reactions to first seeing their desolate posting through the trauma of constant assault and fallen companions until they are eventually sent back to an American base in Italy. There is little to no context outside of the filming, which stretches from May 2007 to July 2008, and a few interviews after the fact with the same platoon of soldiers. Both filmmakers, Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington, are with us now to talk about their film. Congratulations to you both on your nomination for an Oscar.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sebastian, the clip we played just now is from when you were in a Hummer that was hit by an IED. What can you tell us about the experience of being embedded in such a dangerous place?
We knew we were going to get attacked on the way in. They'd picked up radio chatter from the Taliban, and it was a long convoy of vehicles, and it just didn't cross my mind that it would be the Humvee I was in that would get hit. What are the odds? We were second in line. I was with the captain, and the bomb went off under the engine block, and which saved us from injury or worse. But we were on fire and we were taking fire, and so there was a couple of minutes in the Humvee where it was a pretty bad situation, and I was so calm about it, I actually worried that I'd been hit. I wasn't scared at all, and the fear, a lot of fear came later. But in those moments, I was really very calm, and I was so calm I thought I was in shock and maybe I'd been wounded, and so I felt my way down my legs. But I was able to keep filming the whole time. The camera was on in the minutes before the IED hit, and so I caught the explosion on camera, and it was actually ended up being pretty extraordinary footage.
And Tim, you're the photographer. What did you do at that moment?
I wasn't there. Sebastian and I actually ended up like a tag team. I had been on an operation in a few months before and injured myself. So, in the end, what began as a joint operation together going out to the Korangal in the end became a kind of tag team experience, which was interesting.
Who was Restrepo, the namesake of the film?
Restrepo is Juan Restrepo. He was the medic of 2nd Platoon. And interesting enough, in this age of the debate about immigration, Juan was a Colombian-born, naturalized here in the U.S. and died for this country on the side of a mountain in Afghanistan. So the film is named after him. He died early on in the deployment, and his fellow men built an outpost. They called it Restrepo after him. But we also called the film Restrepo because we felt that it was somehow the name was emblematic, a kind of metaphor for every soldier and the sense of loss that every soldier goes through when they go to war.
Let's listen to another clip from the film, this one from one of your exit interviews after the fact.
They're gathering intel right now basically on how to deal with us because there's no really research or intel on how to treat us right now because they haven't had to deal with people like us since, World War II in Vietnam, dealing with guys that are coming back from 15-month deployments with as much fighting, as we went through.
Who was speaking in that clip, Sebastian?
That was Sergeant McDonough. He was the squad leader for First Squad. Those are the guys we spent the most time with. We slept in their hooch, their little plywood hooch that they made. Restrepo was a really remote outpost. It was up on a ridge. There was no running water, no phone to the outside world, no internet. You didn't shower for a month at a time. There was no cooked food. It was really bottled water and MREs and sandbags and ammo, and they were attacked three or four times a day. And in a situation like that, you sort of gravitate towards certain people that you feel good with, you feel safe with. And as the only two men up there without weapons, that definitely sort of played into who, you know, where we wound up in the platoon.
What a way to have to live. And it's interesting. I think this is one of the only moments in the film that you allude to anything that could be called a political reality outside of deployment. There's almost none of the context that we've come to expect from our documentaries. You're simply dropped in with the soldiers and you follow their experience until they leave Afghanistan. And I had the feeling that this was a war movie, but not a political movie and not an agenda movie necessarily. Was that the intent?
Yeah, we wanted to make the most visceral and immersive war film we could. And we felt that when we looked at the media, you know, you find lots of political opinion pieces in the newspapers. If you want to see the data about Afghanistan, it's very easy to find both in the press and on the internet. But what there hadn't been is there hadn't been a kind of reality that brings you close to Afghanistan, that takes you on a 90-minute deployment and brings you into that illusion in much the way that the kind of like Hollywood films do, where you believe you're in that situation. So we didn't want to cut out to a general or a politician or a kind of the big picture, because we didn't want to break the illusion for the viewer that they're suddenly not in the Korongal. They'd be like, oh, okay, I get it. I'm watching a documentary about the Korongal. Rather, we take you into that zone. And what we do is we really show you the emotional terrain. And that's stuff that you don't get in the press. You don't really understand that. And we felt that, you know, we've been at 10 years at war, and that this country really needs to understand the emotional landscape of these young men and women, because ultimately they're coming back to this country and we have to make a place for them.
And so that's your statement, is that we have to understand what they're coming back with, rather than kind of arguing one way or another about the war, Sebastian?
Yeah, I mean, I think if they were coming back with really intense political questions about the war, that would be part of their emotional terrain, as we call it. By the way, the Army divides things up into physical terrain, which is the mountains and rivers and all that that you fight on, the human terrain, which is the society you fight in. And then there's this third kind of terrain, emotional terrain, which the military is not focused on. They don't use that term, but Tim and I do. And that's where we're focused. So the soldiers very notably do not hold political conversations about the overall war. The decisions of their government were not what put them there. In Vietnam, it was. It was a draft army, and the government made decisions that put people in Vietnam, often unwillingly. In this case, what put those guys on that hilltop, it was all men out there, by the way, what put them on that hilltop was their personal decision to join the army and to work very, very hard to get into a combat unit.
Although that put them in the army, still President Bush or President Obama had to decide to deploy and to deploy there and to deploy at that level.
Well, all these guys joined after 9/11, after the wars had started, and they joined the army and explicitly, purposefully joined a combat unit because, as many of them said to both Tim and myself, we wanted combat. We were curious about it. We wanted to experience it.
Another clip from the film. This takes place directly after a firefight, and the first voice is Soldier Kyle Steiner.
Big firefight.
Yeah.
Big. Packing up rounds. That was fun, though, man. That was fun. You can't get a better high. It's like crack, you know? You can skydive or bungee jump or do, you know, kayak, but once you've been shot at, you really can't come down. There's nothing. You can't top that.
Are you going to go back to the civilian world, then?
I have no idea.
Hey, did you hear me go cycling? I had the barrel smoked.
Did you hear me?
Yeah, what was that first burst about, cuz? You was crazy with it. Hey, as soon as I popped my head up, hey, Ollie, guess who? you just slid down the stairs.
I've been game planning it. I was like, yeah, if we hit from there, obviously, I'm going to get on the 240, but I've been wanting to get on the 50 for a while now.
Another excerpt from the Afghanistan War documentary, Restrepo, nominated for a Best Documentary Oscar. We're talking with the filmmaker Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington. And yeah, Sebastian, you just said that these are guys who signed up because they wanted to know what it was like to fight in a war. And it certainly was revealed in that clip.
Yeah.
He even talked about the high being like crack cocaine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, adrenaline's a very, very powerful drug. And if you're exposed to it, you develop a relationship with danger and excitement, which is hard to break free of. I mean, I think there's more profound things going on out there that keep them emotionally connected to that world, but I think adrenaline is definitely one of them.
What are some of the more profound things?
There's a real brotherhood out there that they come to rely on psychologically, emotionally. There's a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning. You know, they're 19, they're 20. They don't have an equivalent sense of purpose in society. They're at the bottom of the food chain in society, but out there they're not. They're completely self-defining, and that for a 19-year-old is gold.
Tim, I think the classic narrative is that somebody like that joins the military because they're macho, because they're curious about war, because they seek adventure, maybe because they're patriotic and want to do something for their country, but it's this whole exciting package. And then over time, as they see their buddies get killed and injured, and maybe they themselves get injured, it starts to wear and tear on them, and they come out very wounded emotionally, if not physically. Is that what you saw?
Well, I think they certainly do come out wounded. But as Aaron Hiar in the film says, you know, at one point he says he's very upset, and he's saying, you know, but I wouldn't give any of it up. You know, I want to hold on to these memories because these define who I am, and that they make me remember the good things in life. And so it's a very kind of complicated emotional territory. They come back home, and once they leave the army, they have that rug pulled from underneath their feet, and no wonder they find it a hard time to transit back home.
It's worth noting that virtually all of them stayed in the army. Like after a deployment where they just were really suffered out there. They had a 25% casualty rate.
Wow.
And they came back to Italy, and only one guy in the platoon got out of the army. They all stayed in, including Steiner, the guy who said that.
And there were five firefights a day, as you document. They were far enough away that help couldn't reach them in time if there was a heavy assault. I just got the sense watching the documentary that it was amazing that there weren't even heavier casualties.
Well, in the valley adjacent to them, where a company called Chosen was, they ran a casualty rate of 80%. Mm. In fact, there was one patrol up to a place called Aranas where all 28 men in the patrol took a bullet, either killed or wounded.
And I guess this is outside the scope of your documentary, but is it considered irresponsible at the level of leadership to deploy the men to where 80% of them might get killed?
Well, now they've actually withdrawn from the Korongal at the end of the film. You learn that, and you know, the strategy has changed. Interestingly enough, I actually met the commander who was responsible for pulling out of the Korongal the other day, and he said to me, he said the one thing that he insisted on is that his men never named outposts after their fallen comrades and friends, because he didn't want the men to become emotionally attached to the land. The idea is, he said to me, is that we fight for pieces of ground, and when strategy changes, we have to move on, and we can't give our attachment to them.
So establishing OP or Strepo turned out to be a bad thing.
We were just documenting what happened, and the idea of OP Restrepo is this idea, again, of the film of showing an emotional narrative to what these soldiers go through. It's for you, the viewer, to see it and decide for yourself.
Let's listen to one more clip from the Oscar-nominated documentary Restrepo. This takes place both in the field, directly after a member of the platoon is killed in action, and then in the interview booth later as two soldiers reflect on how they've dealt with death.
One elf was kind of blaming it on himself because we couldn't push over the top to hit him, but the thing he's got to understand is he was dead instantly. There's nothing you could do right there.
Actually, I can't even sleep, honestly. I've been on about four or five different types of sleeping pills and none of them help. That's how bad the nightmares are. I prefer not to sleep and not dream about it than sleep and just see the picture in my head is pretty bad.
That actually stuck with me for the rest of the deployment. Stuck with me through coming back here to Italy. I still obviously haven't figured out how to deal with it inside. The only hope I have right now is that eventually I'll be able to process it differently. I'm never going to forget it. I'm never going to even let go of it. I don't want to not have that as a memory, because that was one of the moments that makes me appreciate everything that I have.
Another excerpt from Restrepo. The two interviews there were with Miguel Cortez and then Aaron Hiar. Briefly, Sebastian, what was the interview process like with soldiers after having seen them out in the field, and how are they adjusting to life stateside?
They didn't adjust to it. They stayed in the army, and they really never came home. We interviewed them in Italy at their base 3 months later. Tim and I did a total of 10 one-month trips together to Restrepo. So by the time we interviewed them in Italy, we knew them extremely well. We didn't want a narration for the movie. We didn't want someone else's voice to sort of break the illusion that you're in the Korngol, so we wanted to use their voices.
And there ends our rebroadcast for this Memorial Day of the interview we did earlier this year with filmmakers Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington about their Oscar-nominated documentary, Restrepo. As we mentioned at the outset, Tim Hetherington was killed last month while covering the war in Libya. We thought re-airing the interview would be a fitting Memorial Day tribute to him. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.